It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
And welcome to episode 9 of the Dearly Departed Podcast. I'm Mike Dorsey.
I'm Scott Michaels.
And today we're going to tell you a little story about a man named Jed.
And the crew.
And the crew.
And the crew. And his family.
So we are doing the Beverly Hillbillies today, the classic 60s sitcom. Before we get into that, though, hate mail?
Hate mail.
Hate mail. You know, I don't have any hate mail. I really, you know, I've got people leaving shitty comments on my YouTube channels and stuff. But no, everything, you know, everyone's so nice about what we do. I got so many nice emails saying, this isn't hate mail. This is nice mail. So it's cool. It's really nice. So thank you guys for being supportive and reaching out and letting us know that you listen to this. It's cool.
We did have one funny comment, though, on our... We have an old clip from the 6 degrees of Helter Skelter on YouTube. Mm-hmm. That's it's the clip about Shorty Shea, and somebody using the screen name Adolf Hitler said, "I knew Charlie." That was their comment. So, bet you didn't know that about history.
There you are,
Adolf Hitler.
Well, they always say, "What is it that you can define evil?" And they always say. Adolf Hitler and Charles Manson.
Right.
You know, they go hand in hand, which is interesting because Roman Polanski's family were killed in Auschwitz or in one of the death camps, and Roman Polanski's wife and friends were killed by Manson.
People that didn't carve swastikas into their foreheads.
I mean, it's full circle, really.
Yeah, it's crazy. And good news on our how the show's doing so far. We are now averaging 3,500 downloads an episode.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's so cool. I mean, people listen. That's so neat. That's so cool.
Number one episode is still Disney, mm-hmm. which should probably just never be beaten. Mm-hmm. And then number two episode was our pilot about all the Santa Clauses that
Santa
died.
Claus and Tiny Tim.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's so much fun. So thanks. That is so cool.
Yes. Thank you, everybody. All right. News of the week. There's a lot.
News of the week.
There's a lot because, again, it's been a few weeks. First of all, I don't know if you saw this huge fire that happened at Universal back in 2008 that burned a bunch of their music archives.
Yeah.
And there was it's really a scandal because they covered up what the true damage was. And they lost something like 500,000 masters of some of the greatest music ever recorded in American music history. Etta James at last was lost. Mm-hmm. The masters for Nirvana Nevermind supposedly gone. I mean, all these old RCA and everything, music masters were gone. And at the time, I guess, Universal misled the media and the public about the true damage. They said it wasn't a big deal. And then I think like a whistleblower came out recently and exposed what actually happened. So... A bit of our history gone.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me, a couple of years ago, I knew somebody that worked on the Paramount lot, and he told me, I don't know, I was talking about a particular actor, or maybe it was Sunset Boulevard, and he says, why don't you come back to the lot? So we went, he had a key, he's in legal, contracts, and he took me to this weird little shed in the back, and, you know, not air conditioned or anything, and he had a key, and it was this metal door, this tin door. And he opened it up, and they're just floor-to-ceiling file cabinets. And he said, give me a name. I said, Mae West. So he walks over to this file, you know, gets on a ladder and pulls out this Mae West paper file with all the correspondence, like handwritten with Mae West in the studio. And these are all, like, documents, you know, like the real thing. He said, give me another name. I said, Montgomery Clift. And there's notes about, you know, Montgomery Clift wanted to borrow a print from this particular movie so we could show it in this particular place. And it's all their handwritten notes, and it's in this unair-conditioned file in the back of Paramount Studios. And I asked him, why is this here? And he says, well, the Academy wants it because they'd store it and they preserve it, but they won't let us have access to it. So they're kind of like, fuck you, we're keeping it.
Wow.
So it's fascinating, though. I mean, just there. You know, I couldn't believe I had my hands on this stuff. I was looking up the contracts for Grease and how much everyone got paid.
Was it a lot?
No, I remember. The one I remember was that the girl that played Jan. I forget her name. She goes to the church I go to. Oh, what the hell is her name? Jamie Donnelly. She got $2,000 to do it.
To do that movie.
Yeah.
Wow. So I was in Oklahoma City last week.
Yeah.
Which I know you saw, and I went to the Oklahoma City Memorial for the bombing.
Oh.
And it was an exceptional museum. They did an amazing job. I sent you pictures of, like, they had the car that Timothy McVeigh was arrested in.
Those were
insane.
Piece
of crap, you know, 70s sedan that he was in. They have pieces of the Ryder truck, you know, the axle that was shredded that they were able to pull the VIN number off of, which is how they were able to track down that McVeigh had rented it. It's exhaustive. They have, you know, helmets of firefighters that fought, that were at the scene. You know, I mean, everything.
Was anyone
really
else
amazing.
Killed aside from the victims of the bomb? And were any of the first responders killed or anything?
One was, she was actually an off-duty nurse, I think, and she ran into the building to help people, and a piece of debris fell on her and killed her. So she was, I don't know if any other first responders were killed, but she was.
Those pictures were insane. I mean, I couldn't believe that it would seem, when you're looking at it from a different perspective, from an outsider's perspective, how they wouldn't want to tarnish what happened there with putting something with McVeigh in it, you know? It's just the complete story, all facets of it, and it's just an odd, cool thing.
Yeah. And I heard that the Ground Zero Memorial, they visited, you know, the Oklahoma City Memorial, and kind of that was inspired some of what they did with their museum at Ground Zero, New York.
Okay.
Because it's what you start out in a room that looks like a government hearing room, because there was a Water Rights Board Commission building across the street from the bombing, and they were in session. There was a hearing in session. It was being recorded. So you sit there in this room and you hear about 2 minutes of this woman giving her little introductory spiel about how the hearing is going to go, and all of a sudden the bomb goes off. You hear it.
Oh,
you
wow.
hear this massive explosion and people screaming, and then you hear the woman saying, you know, watch out for the downed power lines or something like that, and they had to get out. I mean, and what people may not realize is that bombing destroyed 14 buildings in downtown Oklahoma City. 14 buildings were so destroyed, you know, damaged, they had to be torn down. And when you're standing there, you know, at the memorial where the kind of the park is, where the building used to be, You look around, that part of downtown Oklahoma City is still not, they didn't rebuild really. And there's still a lot of empty lots and parking space lots and parks and stuff around that area there. It just kind of depressed that whole area. I don't think people realize that bomb really destroyed, like, almost feels like it destroyed like a quarter of downtown Oklahoma City. Wow. It was so massive.
That's so crazy. I went there before they destroyed the building, and when there was just chain link fence around it, and people were still tying teddy bears to it and stuff like that.
It's still
that.
There.
Is it really?
Yeah, there's still chain link fence, and there's still stuff being, you know, teddy bears and all kinds of
really?
Stuff.
Really? Yep. Oh my gosh, that was crazy though, to see that building, that shell of that building there, and it was like, I don't know if it really happened this way, but I seem to remember like curtains blowing in the wind and stuff.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. That was crazy. The devastation and absolutely nuts. That recording would be devastating to listen to.
And then a door automatically opens, and then you're in it. You like walk into the museum and you're surrounded.
I just got goosebumps.
It.
That's
it's
crazy.
It's really well done. I mean, it drives home the whole thing. And at first I thought they weren't going to mention McVeigh's name. Like maybe they wouldn't go into it, because the beginning of it didn't really talk about him. But then the whole second half of the museum that you walk through is all about how the law enforcement side and how they captured him and how the trials went and all that stuff. It's the full story. It's really good.
Wasn't he, when he died, wasn't he cremated? I seem to recall he was like scattered in a Burger King or something, in like a drive-thru or something.
Or there was something where they wouldn't disclose where they put him, or it was some, I can't remember what it was.
I have an article about that. I thought it was like a drive-thru Burger King or something. They spread his ashes there. I'll have to look at that. I'll have to look for that. But yeah, I hope you post these pictures. I really want to see them again.
They're cool. And I'll have you know that while I was in Oklahoma City, guess what else they have?
Tell me.
They have a plastic straw ban.
Oh, stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
You had to get paper. In a landlocked state where there's no ocean.
But a turtle got one up its nose.
It's sick. No, paper straws, man.
Oh,
even
my
in local,
God.
Even in one of the reddest states
paper
in the country.
Straws.
Paper
it's like,
straws.
It's like drinking through cloth. I bought one. I have it in my car, a metal one that expands.
They get soggy.
Because I'm so disgusted.
The other news, local LA news, the famous theme building, which you may, people may not know the name of it, but at LAX, that space age central thing is famous, one of the most recognizable landmarks in LA. There's talk it might be turned into a hotel.
It's not big enough for a hotel.
I don't think so either.
Unless they build it, that could be the lobby of a hotel.
And they build around it.
was in that. Have you ever been to the restaurant that was in there? That
when was cool. It was Encounters, owned by Disney. And I remember you go up the elevator and a song would play.
Yeah.
While you go up the elevator. It was really cool. Just like loungy Jetson-y kind of music would play going
up
the elevator.
That was cool. I think the USO, are they using it now for the USO, I think?
Or it's just empty. I don't know. Or maybe it's being used for events. I don't know.
That was a cool building.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm glad
it's protected, so it won't get torn down. It's a historical
monument. It's L.A. It'll get torn down. Well, did you see what they did to that TWA terminal in New York? I mean, that's insane.
I know.
That is...
It's pretty dang cool.
That is massive. in the middle of an airport that can have a hotel. Talk about an invitation for a terrorist attack. But man, is that beautiful.
Yeah. And then, of course, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the 25th anniversary of the O.J. White Bronco chase.
25?
Was this year. It's been 25 years this week that happened. That was one of those moments where, you know, everybody knows where they were, so I always have to ask, where were you when O.J. fled with his buddy?
I think, actually, I was downtown. I went to see Sunset Boulevard, the play with Glenn Close. that day. Yeah, that's where I was downtown.
I know somebody, worked with somebody who, he was an executive who's been in the business a long time, and he was working at Fox at the time, a Fox building, which is on, next to the 405.
Oh, so we saw
there. He all ran out to the overpass and watched him go by.
How did they have enough time to make signs? No, seriously.
I have been, that's a good question.
That's so weird.
I know, but he was one of the, he went out to the overpass and they watched him go by. Because, you know, the people in L.A. had more warning, you know, by the time he got up here. Because by the time he got to them, he was almost to sunset.
Oh, they were going
he
like 25 or something.
They were going, yeah, it took him forever to get here. So
that would have been, you know, it'd be interesting to get a perspective from somebody that was on the road when that went by. There's got to be people out there. If any of you guys, you know, drop us an email. I'd love to hear.
A personal account.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I guess not coincidentally, he launched a Twitter account this week.
He's going to get even, I think.
He says he has a lot of scores to settle or get even with people. It's whatever. Like, oh, okay.
So you a couple of years ago, before any of that TV movie business happened, you told me about the documentary the ESPN did.
Yes.
And they played the entire 911 call or the police conversation that he was having on his cell phone, and that was, I mean, the first jury wasn't able to listen to that, were they?
I mean, it was as close to a confession without being a confession.
I mean, I listened to it again yesterday. It's like, tell them I'm all sorry, you know? I'm the only one who deserves to get
hurt.
That's
the big one. I'm the only one who deserves to get hurt, and all I did was love Nicole. Like, that's the justification of every abusive domestic partner.
So if the jury, I guess they wouldn't let them use it in the first trial.
It was considered prejudicial or whatever.
So, oh my God.
I know.
What a disaster.
I know. So he started the Twitter account, unfortunately.
And those poor Goldmans, you know, that they have to do. I mean, the Browns, whatever. But, no, that's really mean. I really sympathize with the Goldmans because, you know, clearly they're grieving and they're never going to let go. And they shouldn't. It'd be a shame that they can't move on. But I don't blame them for not moving on. And to have to endure this, he's become a comedy act.
Yeah.
You know, he's a curiosity, and he thinks he's Mr. Hip, cool guy. And those poor Goldmans.
And his initial approach coming onto Twitter was just all wrong.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to have a Twitter account, don't be, you know, combative with people.
No,
like,
and he posted the thing about Kylie or one of the Jenners, or that he's supposed to be the father of one of the Kardashians.
Did he post
something.
That? Because that's been a rumor for a long time.
Yeah, he that was his second post. He did a video about Kardashians and how he's not the father, I think.
Oh, he denied it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, monster. I guess there's like a million people following him already, so that's our society.
I'm one of them. I'm guilty.
You can know what he's saying without giving him follow, though.
Yeah, I got. But
you
want to
be alerted.
You're
when
right.
But you want to be alerted
I
when
never,
he posts something.
I never look at
right?
that stuff. But I'm curious about it. Yeah.
I was gonna say I remember where I was during the White Bronco chase.
Where's that?
I was in high school, but I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of all places. That day, I just had an encounter where I almost stepped on a rattlesnake, and we went to a Mexican food place, and we walked in, and there was like a big bar area at the front, kind of like El Coyote.
Yeah.
Everybody was in the bar watching TV. And I looked up, and there was the White Bronco. And I thought, oh, it must be just another random police chase. And someone's like, no, it's O.J.
I remember that,
time stood still when that moment
happened.
It
did. And then, but they, you know, one of the playoff championships was playing at the same time.
Yeah, NBA.
And they were playing them side by side. So they're basically, you know, that he said that I've listened to some psychoanalyst or whatever talking about it. He goes, by putting the basketball game in on the same screen, you're mm-hmm. justifying this whole thing as entertainment.
Right.
And it's so interesting.
Well, that's what's great about that ESPN thing you just mentioned, which it's called June 17th, 1994. It's an episode of 30 for 30 that came out in 2010, directed by Brett Morgan, who also did The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Oh,
which is
that.
One of the best documentaries about... people stop calling. I hate when the same person calls you like three times in a row and you're like, you know, this isn't the 80s. Like, I can see that you called.
You don't have to leave
a message.
I
will call you back when I'm available.
It's me.
You don't have to keep trying. Anyways, June 17th, 1994 is the name of this documentary. And it's fantastic because there's no narration. And there are no new interviews. It is entirely made up of archival footage that they put together.
Yeah, that was good.
To what was happening that day in the sports world, in addition to all this, like you were just saying, Arnold Palmer was playing his last round of the U.S. Open. He was doing his big farewell while this happened.
Mm-hmm.
The 94 World Cup commencement, which was happening in the U.S., was happening. I think Clinton spoke at the commencement thing. So they were covering that. The New York Rangers were having a parade for winning the Stanley Cup. Ken Griffey Jr. was tying one of Babe Ruth's home run records, and Game 5 of the NBA Finals between the Rockets and the Knicks was happening right in the middle of this. And one of my favorite parts of that documentary is Bob Costas is there, and he's covering, I think, the finals, and they've got OJ in the lower window, the little inset window on the bottom corner of the screen. So you get the main screen is the basketball mm-hmm. game, and then, like you said, the OJ chase is happening in the corner of the screen. And then they were basically reached a point where we need to make this the main screen now, because this is a bigger story than an NBA Finals game. And they got great footage of Costas kind of like during commercial breaks talking to his producers, and he's arguing with them like, how are we going to segue to this? Like, how do you cut away from this? It's going to look terrible. Like, you like kind of what you said, you're making this, it's like, it's going to look like we're making entertainment out of this. And but they ended up doing it, because that was... No story was bigger than that day than OJ running.
And the 405 freeway was a big part of that story. And this was June. I wonder if was the 10 or the 110 open at that point? Because the Northridge had closed it down. Remember the whole bridge fell over in the Northridge quake?
Oh.
So, because I moved here like 2 weeks after the Northridge quake.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the freeways were still closed
right.
because of that. So I just wonder if they were all operational at that point. Interesting.
And then, of course, there's also another great scripted series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. Did you watch that?
Yeah, I did.
That was really good. I felt like I knew the trial well, and yet I watched that, and I felt like I didn't know anything.
Yeah, that was interesting. And it was the first time I ever saw Sarah Paulson and didn't cringe.
No, right.
Really, she was good as Marsha Clark.
She was fantastic.
Yeah.
She was really good. And she's become like friends with Marsha Clark, I think, and has promoted her and... Took her around on the tour, you know, when they...
Is Marsha Clark a lesbian?
I don't know, but she's a...
she's got kids.
But she's
right.
a TV producer and an author now and everything.
Doesn't matter. She has kids. Lesbians can have children.
Correct.
But Sarah Paulson is.
Okay. here's another one that's kind of up your alley, Scott. South L.A. Post Office dedicated to Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye on Father's Day, wasn't
on Father's Day. Why is that significant, Scott?
Because his father murdered him. That is weird. I mean, that was like somebody didn't do the research of all days. No, that was weird. The Marvin Gaye Post Office. And, you know, it's weird. Remember when they used to have, there was a law, like they couldn't have any people that were ever arrested on stamps. You know, and
really?
Yeah, and there was nobody that was ever like a junkie, or you know, they got people that OD'd now, Janice and Jimmy,
right.
And so it was just interesting. But there, you know, it's also weird. Remember Hirschfield, the guy that did the illustrations for the Brown Derby, or it wasn't the Brown Derby? I think it was Sardi's. But he did those caricatures of famous people,
uh-huh, right.
And he would hide Ninas in them. You know, his daughter's name was Nina.
Oh, so, I didn't know that.
So if you look, when he signed his name, there'd mm-hmm. be a number 1, 2, 3, 4, and that meant how many Ninas were hidden in this picture.
Oh, interesting.
The guy, there was also that big mural of his in the Frolic Room. And there's a bunch of Ninas in it too. It's kind of cool. Huh. But anyway, they weren't going to let him use a stamp because they had a secret message in it. That was going
right.
to say, no, you can't do any of that because there are secret messages in that. So since stamps they wouldn't let him do it. There you go. That was a dumb tangent.
Yeah, I love post office tangents. For all you stamp collectors out there. Leslie Van Houten denied parole by the governor of California. Mm-hmm. No shock there. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know why parole is made political, but it is for some reason. I mean, what governor is ever going to free a member of the Manson family? None.
Yeah.
So it's a bit silly. If the parole board says let him out, I really think whoever it is,
And, I mean, realistically, take away the name Manson and Van Houten, and she'd have been out a long time.
All of those guys,
contrary to what everyone thinks, she was never sentenced to be killed. Mm-hmm. She was. She got three trials, actually, and she was eligible for parole in 79. So I'm no justification, no defending.
No sympathy at all for them as murderers, obviously. Right. I just think it's they've been sitting in jail for 50 years, and if a parole board says you can go...
Computer says no.
Yeah, you know, it's a bit silly. But you had Manson news. You have a Manson.
Well, yeah, this there were these three girls that were in the movie Helter Skelter in 76. They're coming to the shop on Sunday.
Your shop?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they want to do like a, I guess they're doing another Manson movie. Of course, there's a jillion of them out there now.
How can they?
And these, one of them has a book.
What has not been mined yet from that story that we don't
Although know I just got a new book called Chaos, Manson, the 60s, and the Secret Service or something like that.
Oh, all right.
It's this whole government thing about, you know, Manson being on, you know, police informant and
all. He was everything.
I know, right?
Things to all people.
But
amazing.
This one of the girls that was in the she played Krenwinkel in the 76 version of Helter Skelter, and she was also the face of the demon in The Exorcist.
Huh.
And she has a book out, and three of these actresses are going to be at the shop on Saturday afternoon,
like,
signing autographs.
Oh, signing autographs.
Yeah,
okay.
And talking about this new project.
There you go, Scott's Shop on Santa Monica Boulevard.
Yeah, so if you're on Instagram, Dearly Departed Tours, you'll hear about it, or on Facebook or whatever.
I see that Tom Petty's estate is still...
You know what?
How does that happen? It's always the kids versus the stepmom.
It's the money.
It's always the kids versus the stepmother every time. And I just don't understand. You know, if you're a celebrity or anybody with a lot of money and you're in that situation where you're remarried and you have adult children from your first marriage, make it clear like what's supposed to happen.
It's it is sad that. And it's always the people fighting over the money are never the ones that earned it.
Right.
You know, it's always always the remnants, the entitled remnants of their family. Remnants, that's not very nice. But no, I have no sympathy for little monster children that demand things.
I guess it depends. I don't know. I mean, I guess I can see it both ways.
Well, remember Sinatra when he married Barbara Marx, and none of the kids liked her at all. They hated her guts. And Sinatra... basically, in his will, said if anyone, she gets everything, and if anyone objects to this, they get a dollar. They get their inheritance taken down to a dollar. So the kids are just like, oh.
We just talked about something similar to this with Terry Melcher on our last show. Remember Terry Melcher, because Doris Day had died.
Yeah.
And Terry Melcher talked about being cut off from various people.
It was his son. It was
his
grandson
that had been cut off from that side of the family. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Probably for good reason.
Maybe, but also just for similar, you know. You got the thing, the elder abuse thing going on now with the Stan Lee, the Marvel Comics guy estate.
That's so
thing,
awful.
Where, you know, a guy kind of inserts himself in and cuts the family out, and it's crazy. So
it's so sad.
Okay, you want to do deaths or do you
have
something
else? Well, wait, I wanted to talk about, last night I went to the soft opening of the Formosa Cafe.
This is exciting because I was working across the street while it was being renovated this past, like, year or so.
Yeah.
And it's been wild to watch it.
It has been. The Formosa, I'm sort of sentimental, but that was my drinking hole back in the early 90s when it was still, you know, the ceiling was falling apart and you could still smoke. And that's where I met Cass. She was the hostess, whose daughter was Cammy, who was married to Jay Sebring, Sebring.
All right.
And that's how I started going there. And the Formosa looks beautiful. I went in thinking, I'm going to hate it because it's going to be really nothing like I remembered it to be. But they did an amazing job. And you know what's weird is that they had, all along the ceiling, they had these 8x10s.
Mm-hmm.
They had them in the old place.
Right.
And
old people's headshots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then some of them were so bad with like red Dymo tape, you know, with names on them. And above the bar used to be Anne Margaret. And Cass used to joke about it. She goes, that girl looks like her head got cracked off because she's sitting there with a funny pose. And I was looking, I go, what's not there? I'm kind of bummed about that. And a friend of mine looked around. She goes, there she is on the opposite wall. But that same picture's there, which is kind of cool.
So you know it's the same one. Yeah.
But our mutual friend Allison Martino brought me. And I was really impressed because the train car now looks like a train car.
Right.
And there's like rooms back there. They were never back there before. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like the main room and the train car, but there's like three more bars.
That was the weird thing.
Now.
thing walking behind the place while it was under construction. I could look into it, and I saw that. Wow. I was like, wow, there's a whole big space back here I never saw that I never knew was
it
there.
And
there's like an upstairs deck area, too, which I don't know if they're going to open that up or not.
They probably are. Like, I mean, it wasn't. I remember Vince, who was the owner's son, who eventually inherited it, tried to make it hip. So he opened up that thing. I'd never been up there personally, but I'm sure they're going to incorporate that outside space in a bar. Yeah,
right.
Definitely,
especially in LA.
Yeah,
especially on a rooftop.
Yeah,
that's
right.
What we do. For those of you who don't know, the Formosa Cafe is one of these institutions in LA that's been around for generations.
It's across the street from the old United Artists Studio, where they But it was a place where, you know, John Wayne used to get drunk. It's where Marilyn did this. It's
right.
where everyone, you know, that scene from L.A. Confidential.
Yeah.
You know, a whore cut to look like Lana Turner is still a whore.
That is Lana Turner. And what happened was they got bad owners a few years ago who renovated it. And basically
really
ruined it.
I mean, it was silver inside. It was so ugly. It was heartbreaking.
And then some new owners that are into restoration bought it, and this is
beautiful.
Brought it back to life.
I mean, I was really moving to go in there and see it look good.
And you met somebody that you had met before?
I have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to this John Waters sort of lecture, and he's touring with a book. I forget the name of his new book, but he is so funny. I mean, he is...
Great speaker.
Yes, fantastic. And Mr. Know-It-All is the name of his new book. And so afterwards, you know, you got a book with the admission, and he did a little signing at the end of it, and I walked up to him. And I'd spent some time with him before. I mean, like real time. Like we talked for about an hour one-on-one many years ago.
Wow.
And so I just said to him, Troy, my husband was with me, and I walked up to him. I said, do you still have that piece of John Denver's airplane I gave you? Because I remember when they gave it to him, he was going to get on a plane in like an hour. He's like, I'm taking this with me. But he goes... Yes. He says, he says, where do I know you from? I said, well, it was the green room at Graham Norton's show. He goes, yes. I remember you were Graham's boyfriend, weren't you? I said, yeah. He says, I still see him when I go to London. I said, oh, good for you. I don't. But he goes, oh, it was like that, was it? I said, well, it is now. But I invited him because he was obsessed with Jane Mansfield. If you ever look at like some of his early movies, I mean, Divine was doing Jane Mansfield. Divine, you know, he put her in Jane's wedding gown. And Edith Massey was wearing that bizarre crisscross leathered skin tight thing. Uh-huh. And those were all Jane Mansfield huts. So I invited him to come and see the car. So I hope he does.
Yay.
Go. Oh, and I had him sign my, I have a God Bless Our Mobile Home plate. Because and I had him sign it with my favorite line. It's Happy Birthday, Fatso. So he signed that.
A new addition to the Dearly Departed Museum. I love it. Deaths?
Did you keep track of any of those? We had a few recently.
It was, you know, luckily it was a light few weeks in the death world. But
I remember Sylvia Miles.
Carmine Caridi, who was Carmine Rosato in Godfather 2. He's kind of got infamous. He's one of the only people to ever be expelled from the Academy. Because of doing something that everybody does, which is he shared his screeners, the screener DVDs that you get for award season.
Yeah.
They send, you know, the studios send you copies of the movies, and you're not supposed to share. I mean, you cut them up, whatever. I'm always very careful with mine, but I know a lot of people that do share theirs around. And you know, if you're in the Producers Guild or the Writers Guild or the SAG or any of those groups that have award shows for films, you get all these screener DVDs. And he got in trouble for sharing his, and expelled him for it.
Oh, my God.
Yep. And he got sued by a couple of studios, too, and then I think he ended up winning out in those lawsuits. But, yeah, they...
You know, now it's all digital,
No, we still get a lot of DVDs.
Okay.
There's a lot of people that send you links, but I think they realize that's not as tangible and effective.
I thought you entered a code or something.
Yeah, I'd rather get a disc.
You want that.
Yeah. But I always get rid of mine like I'm supposed to, but a lot of people don't, so...
And I remember Ellen DeGeneres, hers got... like hacked or something, and then like 800 copies of her screeners got out.
Because some of them supposedly are like digitally watermarked, so they can tell who they were. I don't know if that's really true or not, but I remember when I first moved to LA, I didn't know what it was. I saw some for sale in like a used movie store. I was like, that is ballsy, to sell your screener copies with the watermark on them.
And they just shut down one of those file sharing services for that reason. They were showing Disney movies, they were showing movies and cutting out all the racy parts.
Oh, right.
And the studio sued them, and I don't know how many
of course,
gajillions. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oh, man, people don't understand intellectual property law. The big, probably the biggest death of the past few weeks has been Gloria Vanderbilt. This past week, the heiress and fashion designer and Anderson Cooper's mom at 95 from stomach cancer. And I don't know if you guys watched it, but Anderson Cooper made a really nice tribute to her on CNN. It was very heartfelt, and we'll post a link to it.
Did you hear about his brother that committed suicide?
Anderson Cooper's?
Yeah, in front of Gloria Vanderbilt. Oh, like, he jumped out a window, like, right in front of them.
Oh, wow. No,
yeah,
I did
really,
not.
It was really, really wild. Yeah, no, it's a fascinating story.
Wow. I did not know that, no.
She, talk about a woman that went through it, though. I mean, as a child, you know, being that the poor little rich girl, that's what they called her.
Right.
And the whole estate.
But she had a lot of, she seemed like a fascinating person. She was into a lot of different things. Yeah. You know what I mean?
The interview that he did with her, that they broadcast in his tribute, was really interesting. And she had it together till she died, which is really pretty cool. And she went fast, so good for her.
Yeah, they like found out that she was sick, and she, you know, she passed away a few weeks after that diagnosis.
But I think she was the first designer jeans. I think before
That's
even
right.
Calvin Klein.
Yep. They credit her with inventing the designer jean, essentially, as we know it. Yeah. So I saw last night, I got to go, thanks to one of our listeners, David, who I'm friends with. We a group of us went and saw Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West. At the Tarantino's theater there, the New Beverly.
Yeah.
They screened it last night, a print of it, a 35mm print of it. And beforehand, I did not know this, but a member of the cast who played one of the, you know, named characters in it committed suicide while they were filming that movie. He jumped out of his hotel window wearing his cowboy costume from the movie.
Wow.
And he survived the fall, but didn't survive the bumpy ride to the hospital.
What?
And as legend has it, Sergio Leone shouted, get the costume, we need the costume.
Oh, that's funny. That's great. That's great. Did you see that Tarantino put up new posters, new Rick Dalton posters at the Aquarius?
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, Rick Dalton is this fictional character that Leonardo DiCaprio plays, and he plays a Western actor who's kind of on the outs. But in front of the Aquarius Theater or Earl Carroll or whichever you want to call it, they left up the painting that they used to make it look like the 60s again. Uh-huh. But in front of it are the posters that Tarantino, like, they're real movie posters, but they're Rick Dalton posters. It's cool. It's really cool.
Oh, that's awesome. So he's kind of playing around with that.
Yeah.
That whole, yeah.
Making him like a real person. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Wrap up.
Never mind. I can tell. Well, no, I can tell you. What? I contacted the Tarantino people, and I'm getting screen credit. So I'm excited about that.
You heard it here first, folks. Scott Michaels is getting screen credit on Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
You can see the smile on my face. Yes. I am so geeked.
Yeah.
It is like big time. That, to me, this is like the biggest thing. That is the coolest thing. So, I'm hoping I can get an autograph poster out of it.
You should.
I hope so.
And an invitation to one of the premieres, I would think, right?
I wouldn't think.
I mean, they didn't fly to Cannes, but, you know, maybe here in Hollywood, right?
If it's not Cannes, I'm not going.
To wrap up the deaths of the month, Italian director Franco Zeffirelli died at 96. His most famous film probably was 1968's Romeo and Juliet. And he also did Tea with Mussolini in 99.
And there's an association with Helter Skelter.
Of
Olivia
course
Hussey. Used to live in the house on Cielo Drive after the murders.
Wait, who did?
Olivia Hussey, the woman that played Juliet.
Oh, all right.
And she moved into Cielo Drive after the murders.
No kidding.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
I always thought that Altobelli moved directly in, but he ran into somebody else
guest
between?
House. He was guest house. He always... it's weird how it, I forget if she lived in the guest house or what.
Right.
But she moved onto the property after the murders.
Crazy.
Weird.
That is weird. Sylvia Miles... 94, Midnight Cowboy?
Yeah, Midnight Cowboy. I remember mostly because there was a movie in the 80s called Funhouse, and she played this old fortune teller who was giving the monster hand jobs. Oh, man, it was great. I love that movie.
That's a legacy.
She was, but I liked her because she didn't give a shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She wore the wackiest makeup, and she was the craziest characters. I thought that was pretty cool.
And Jim McMullen, who was a kind of a character actor, he was in Dallas and Austin Powers, is dead at 82. So
rest in peace.
Rest in peace, everybody. All right, well.
Half an hour into our podcast.
Let's get to the point.
The Beverly Hillbillies all died. Thank you.
And we're wrapped.
It's time for the main feature.
So, Beverly Hillbillies, for those who don't know, it was a sitcom on CBS, ran for 9 seasons from 1962 to 1971. 274 episodes, which is just...
In 9 seasons.
It's crazy. It was number one on TV for its first 2 seasons, and it was actually still going strong in 71, but CBS, there was a cultural shift away from rural-based stories or rural targeting shows.
Basically, they targeted Paul Henning. It was like Green Acres, Petticoat Junction.
They kicked them all. Exactly. Yeah. All his stuff got wiped off. Then the setup for it, of course, was the Clampets are the hillbillies who strike it rich with oil, and they end up making $25 million, which in 1962 to today's dollars would be worth $211 million today. And they are encouraged to move to Beverly Hills for some reason.
Yeah,
and they live in this giant mansion.
Yeah.
And it's all about fish out of water. They're trying to learn about modern culture and rich lifestyles.
What is it that Connecticut King Arthur's Court thing? Isn't that what it was all about, was taking somebody and putting it into a situation socially different? Mm-hmm. But that show, I mean, there was episodes of that that got 60 million
Right.
60 million
right.
viewers.
Back when they were like 3 channels. But yeah, that's how things were back then.
Though. That's crazy. I mean, that show is like lucky to get like 3 or 4 anymore. 60 million. It was like, I think a couple of them are still amongst the top 10 highest rated, aren't they?
Yeah, there's one. I think one of their episodes is still to this day the highest rated half-hour comedy episode in television history. It hasn't been beat.
That's nuts. 60 million people. but I remember when it came. Oh, I don't remember when it came out. I was born that year. But one of the reviews, because they trashed it. Like Gilligan's Island, anything that becomes a classic is something that people don't like initially. But they had one of the critics said, if television is America's vast wasteland, the hillbillies must be Death Valley, which is quite clever, actually. If you're going to be nasty, at least be clever.
Well,
about
that
it.
Vast wasteland is a quote of that FCC guys that we talked about. Oh, the Gilligan's Island. That's what he called television. He called it a vast wasteland. So it must have picked up and been kind of requoted and turned into other people's quotes. The Bel Air Mansion, which is real and still exists to this day, it's called Chartwell, which was all the establishing outside shots were done at. Designed by architect Sumner Spaulding, who also designed the casino on Catalina Island, and some other big mansions that are famous around L.A. I think it's currently listed for $245 million, or at least it was last year, which makes it the nation's most expensive real estate listing. It is 25,000 square feet on 10 acres in Bel Air.
A lot of people don't think it's gone. I mean, it's because I remember when I first moved here, you could still get to the driveway, and still that tree-lined driveway. I took pictures of it. And it still looks, I mean, do Google Earth, it still looks exactly the same, except, you know, the house itself does. Mm-hmm. And those trees, those really distinctive ficus trees are still there, too. But what's kind of funny is that, some irony, I guess, they lived next door to the Drysdales. And in the show, of course. In real life, that mansion, it was originally called the Kirkaby Mansion. The Reagans moved next door.
Oh, really?
Yeah, their retirement home was next door to the Beverly Hillbillies. So sort of like, you know, she's like Mrs. Drysdale.
Right.
And, you know, kind of funny.
Nancy Reagan is Drysdale.
With a big poodle.
For those of you who don't know, the Drysdales were, Mr. Drysdale owned the bank.
Bank?
It was his bank that they put the money
into.
Yeah,
he's the president.
And then he just, yeah that's what I meant, yeah. And then he bought a house next door to theirs because they're his biggest client now.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't realize what they're like until he meets them. And then his wife is super snooty and, you know, snobbish.
I love her. Oh my God, she was great.
And so it's kind of, a lot of the comedy comes from the clash of those two, you know, families. So, Cousin Pearl, played by B. Benaderet, was the first to pass away, October 13th, 1968. She was in the middle of filming Petticoat Junction. That show was going strong at the time, which she was a star of. She was 62 years old. She died from lung cancer.
I remember when she died. That was one of the first celebrity deaths I remember. And I think they recorded like an episode with the back of an actress's head.
Right, because they had her dialogue recorded and they dubbed her over it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then June Lockhart moved in and took over her you know, role as a doctor that moved into the Shady Rest Hotel. But but yeah, she was, you know, Betty Rubble. I mean, she was pretty B. Benaderet. And people always say Benaderet or Benaderet. It's Benaderet.
It's Benaderet, yeah.
Somebody said Benaderet recently. How nice. But she's buried at Valhalla and right by Criswell, the psychic.
Oh, wow. I wonder if you knew that was going to happen.
But there's something that we should address about this show. It's such a bizarre show. How this concept got launched.
Right.
This family dynamic. I had to write it down. I mean, Uncle Jed, or Buddy Ebsen, he was a widower, and he was the head of the household. Granny, Irene Ryan, played his mother and Ellie's grandmother. So Jed Clampett was Ellie Mae's father. Granny was his wife's mother. And and Donna Douglas was his daughter, and Jethro was the nephew, his sister's kid. Right. I mean, it's like, where did this come from? Why couldn't they just have, a family? But
right.
There were all these bizarre family twists, mm-hmm. and it's like, where did that come from in 62? That's bizarre.
Right.
But it's and cousin, she played originally, B. Benaderet played Cousin Pearl, who was Jethro's mother, and then she moved on to play Kate. Kate Bradley in Petticoat Junction, which was a spinoff of the Beverly Hillbillies.
Wow.
Isn't it interesting?
Yes.
And Linda K. Henning played Betty Jo, who was Paul Henning's daughter, who created the show. But he didn't create Green Acres. That's the funny bit. Because they're all Hooterville, Pixley, But Green Acres has a different feel to it. He produced it, though. But I mean, Green Acres is genius. I mean, have you watched any shows recently?
I mean,
the way they did the credits, like she'd be outside collecting eggs, and they'd be like, the credits would be on the eggs.
Oh, wow.
And then one time they were in bed, and the white, I don't know what you call that, when the screen credits come on, it says, produced by Paul Henning, and they're laying in bed, and she gets up, she goes, who's Paul Henning? She's looking at the letters. I mean, it was just really weird.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. She was married to Jim Bannon originally, who was the Red Ryder cowboy hero on the Red Ryder
series. Oh, that's a BB gun, isn't it? Is that a Red Ryder BB gun? The one from Christmas Story.
Yeah. So she was married to the guy that was based off, to play that character. And then they got divorced, and her second husband was a guy named Eugene Twombly. He had a massive heart attack the day after her funeral and was buried next to her.
Interesting. And
he died like 4 days after she did.
And her name is Twombly. It isn't Benaderet on her tombstone or on her plaque on her crypt. It's Beatrice Twombly.
There you go.
Oh, you know what? Dearly Departed Tours is now a cemetery on Find a Grave.
What? Are you kidding?
Yeah.
You're listed as a cemetery because you have remains.
We have seven people in our shop. And I wrote A.J. Merrick, who's one of the moderators of Find a Grave. And I go, I have Michu in my shop and some of Pugsley. Does that count as a cemetery? He goes, oh, yeah. So now we're on Find a Grave as a cemetery.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Academy.
Okay. After Benaderet, the next person to pass away was Irene Ryan, who played Granny.
Reenie is what they used to call her. Yeah.
Reenie. She died on April 26th, 1973, so just a couple years after the show was canceled at 70. It's kind of crazy. She was still only 70.
I know.
So she was in her late 50s and 60s while she was playing Granny, which looks like an 80-year-old.
And she was only 5 years older than Buddy Ebsen.
Yeah,
which is and contrary to what I thought she died on stage, but she had a stroke on stage and was brought in New York. She was doing Pippin. She had a stroke during the performance, and then she flew back to L.A., and that's where she died.
She had a brain tumor what they determined. That's kind of like Ma on Golden Girls. The actress was not that much. I think was actually one of the younger actresses, even though she plays the mother, right?
Yeah. That was, but I had dinner with Max Baer one time, and he told me, well, I guess we could talk about that another time.
Yeah, we're getting to Max Baer in a second.
But he had a good story about Irene Ryan. They got along really, really well, and one time they were on the set, and she turned, and he said, she wore those army boots on the show, and she just totally brought it down on his foot, just smashed his foot with her, and he goes, what? She goes, you're in my key light. I mean, they had a good relationship. It was just kind of funny.
Right. Next?
Next. Who's next?
Next to pass away was Raymond Bailey, who was Milburn Drysdale, a.k.a. Mr. Drysdale, the wealthy banker antagonist. He died on April 15th, 1980, 75 years old. He had Alzheimer's, and I think he died of a heart attack.
He was really bitter. He was not
Really?
A happy person. Everyone that worked with him basically said, don't start a conversation with him. He is so negative and so awful, you wouldn't want to be around him.
Wow.
The only one that he was friends with on the set was Nancy Culp, and she's the only one that could deal with him, really. And she was, you know, she'd talk him down from his tirades and stuff, but people just didn't want to be around him because he was so, he would always complain. He would keep everybody waiting on the set. And at the end, he was pissed off because Buddy Ebsen didn't give him work on Barnaby Jones. Jones.
Oh,
and so he, if he had something to complain about, he did. And yeah, I guess it made for some tense moments on the set.
That's too bad. There was also, I know, Buddy Ebsen and I think Culp also had a rivalry, political rivalry with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Over difference of politics. Harriet McGibbon, who was Margaret, Mrs. Drysdale, passed away on February 8th, 1987 at 81 years old, heart and lung failure, and she is at Forest Lawn.
Yes, she is. I found her by accident one day, as you do. But she was funny. Like, where did she, I love Mrs. Drysdale. She was a great character. And it's like she's one of those people that that came from that era in Hollywood with those bizarre accents that come from nowhere.
Yeah, they call it the mid-Atlantic prim and proper accent.
Yeah, Actorland.
It's Cary Grant and Grace Kelly, that whole.
But he was British, though. He was British, wasn't he?
English-born American actor.
Yeah.
So, yes, you're
correct. Yeah, he traveled with the circus.
But
they had anyway.
That prim and proper, they call it the mid-Atlantic.
Is that
accent?
Mid-Atlantic.
It's called Mid-Atlantic.
Oh,
it's
so like, between Britain
and here.
It's
like a cross between an American and a British accent.
Yeah, Billy Burke, the Glinda the Good Witch, had it too. You know, ooh, yes. it's like Actorland.
Right. Nobody else speaks like this. It's the clear pronunciation.
But she was a great character. She was.
And speaking of Culp earlier, Nancy Culp, who was Miss Jane Hathaway, which was the Drysdale's assistant, right, or secretary? Is that
the secretary.
Basically, February 3rd, 1991, 69 years old of cancer.
Now, Nancy, she was an interesting lady. I talked to her on the phone once. It was a radio call-in, I think it was.
Was at a radio station and you called in?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And I just asked, you know, I just wanted to talk to him. I mean, I you know, they put me on hold and I just came up with a question really quick. I don't even remember what it was. but she was one that sipped from the furry cup. She did.
And she never came out publicly, but she hinted at it quite.
Yeah. And Max said
pretty overtly and hinted at it.
She had a girlfriend during the show, even though she was married for a while. But she was. She went back to Pennsylvania, I think.
Yeah, and that's where she ran for office.
Was it in PA?
Yep, in Pennsylvania, she ran for a congressional seat.
Oh,
and that's when Buddy Ebsen recorded a ad for her Republican rival.
You know,
and she got stomped.
Yeah, she did. I remember. She said she put her whole life savings in this thing. And the reason Buddy got involved is because she was implying in the ads that the hillbillies were behind her.
Oh,
so Buddy came out and just made an audio recording or a video recording just saying, you know, Nancy, I love you, but you're too liberal for me.
Right.
And she lost that campaign.
She lost like 66% to 33. It was like a 2-1 loss.
Yeah. I can see why she'd be bitter. They end up making up.
Yeah. He claimed they did before she passed away.
She did. Yeah. She acknowledged that. But yeah, that was the reason he got involved. She did. I have this. I'm going to give it to you. Maybe you post it on the blog. This bizarre photo shoot that she did. It is just she dressed like Ellie Mae. There's one of her dressed like Barbara Streisand, one of her dressed like Baby Jane, Lucille Ball and Sophia Loren, Nancy Culp.
For what? It.
I don't remember. I was just looking through my files yesterday. I found it. I got to send it to you because these pictures are out of control. They're so funny.
Did they? I was watching some of the first season because I was not. I'm not like a super fan of the show, but I noticed that Kellogg's was their sponsor at least in the first season, and they actually worked it into the theme song at the beginning.
Oh,
the little,
yeah.
The little, you know, the theme song with the banjo. They worked, you know, KELLOGS Kellogg's cereals, blah blah blah. Like it was part of the theme song, and they show them riding past a Kellogg's billboard.
Oh, that's
on the street.
Great.
I mean, you talk about brand integration.
Yeah. I remember Jethro would eat he would eat during the show. He'd eat that. They'd have it on the table. That's where I got my that weird thing you get when people chew. It makes me insane. And he used to chew like really.
Chomp.
Yes. Oh my God, it made me crazy. I still can't bear being around people that chew like that.
Okay, and then Buddy Ebsen, who is Jed Clampett, the dad. July 6, 2003, 95 years old of respiratory failure. As I say, he died from being 95.
He was, he had heart surgery. He had a pig's valve inserted. And I was reading this this article about him. Of course, I save every article, and I'm glad I kept them. But there's one thing where he had an attack. Some kind of attack. He was choking, and it was so serious that food and liquid were leaking out of his esophagus. Isn't that bizarre?
Wow.
It's just like, oh, okay. That's that's interesting. But I had, I could talk about this now. About 25 years ago, maybe more than that, I was living in Chicago, and my buddy Steve Cox, who I got to give a shout out, we whore out his books. I mean, you know, it's like he did the Gilligan book, and he did The Hillbillies, and he did one of Green Acres, and et cetera. So, but anyway, Steve calls me and he goes, you know, we're doing this show this next week, or maybe it was even tomorrow. It's Jerry Springer show in San Francisco. And this is back before Jerry started doing the JRE business. I mean, right. It was a legit talk show.
Yeah.
And he had Max and Donna and Buddy and a character actor named Louis Nye, who's a show business legend. And they were all doing the Springer show. And Steve goes, you want to go? I'm like, are you kidding? So I was thinking it was in San Francisco for a day, but it was the most surreal evening. You know, I sat in the trailer with Buddy Ebsen and Louis Nye, and we're just talking while they're getting their makeup done. And Donna's in a weird little world. I'll tell you about when we get into her story. She was.
And do you remember what you talked about, or were you do you ask him anything?
You know, I had breakfast with Louis Nye, and I just wanted to talk about the Munsters because he played Zombo. You know, the kids show host, monster host. But you know, sadly, I was so excited about being there that I didn't really retain anything. You know, if I'd have thought, because I've never been around famous people before, so it was an opportunity that now they're all dead, and it would have been cool to go. What happened there?
Right.
But it was a freaking amazing thing. And then, I'll tell you about Max and Donna when we get to them. But Buddy was awesome, and I got a picture with him, and he looked like shit then.
Well, and for people who don't know, he had a very long career in Hollywood, and famously lost the part of the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. When they were using aluminum dust originally as the makeup, and that infected his lungs, or he had an allergic reaction.
Yeah, real aluminum.
And nearly killed him.
Yeah.
He was in the hospital for like 2 weeks, and it took him like another month after that to fully recover from it, and by then they had recasted it.
And he didn't sue.
And they kept it a secret what happened. People didn't find out till years later what had really happened with him, and they ended up switching from aluminum dust to an aluminum paste. So that wouldn't happen again. So he lost, you know, one of the most famous roles in Hollywood history.
He still shows up in the movie though.
And he claimed, he still, some of his singing can be heard at the end, I believe.
Well, he's one of the Winky guards. One of the first things they filmed with a Winky. So when they show them running into the castle, it's him.
And you can hear his voice supposedly on the last song, like one of the last songs as they're leaving the castle, or I can't remember what it is. Because it was like an ensemble song, and they'd already recorded it, so they just left it. And he claimed until like the end of his life that he never fully recovered from that. He had lung problems for the rest of his life.
Yeah, he made it for he had good innings, as they say. But there was that famous scene that he did tap dancing in that Shirley Temple movie with him. With her, and she refused an invitation to his funeral for some reason.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe she just said she was busy, but I wrote it down in my notes. She refused it. So I don't know.
Wow. Anything else on Buddy?
We talked about he and his sister Vilma. They were a dancing team.
They were like a vaudeville.
Yeah, thing, they were bigger. I mean, they were better than Fred and Ginger. I mean, these guys were good. If you ever see on YouTube, there's clips of them dancing, and they were really good. Fred and Ginger got it going on. You know, they had the studios behind them. But he and his sister were really pretty incredible dance team.
And then I think she retired, and then he continued on.
Crockett. I mean, he did some. He had Barnaby Jones. I mean, that's three pretty big shows.
Back to back to back.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. We didn't talk about Barnaby Jones. So, you know, he did do... Well, I mean, Barnaby
Jones. I'm not familiar with that show. I just know of it.
Okay. Well, he was a detective, and his secretary... I just saw her the other day, too, at the Hollywood Museum. What's her name? Not Lee... Is it Lee Merriweather? Played his secretary? I think she was one of the Catwomen. Yeah, she was Catwoman in the Batman movie. But anyway, yeah, it was he played a private detective. And it was, you know, just one of those 70s detective shows. There were a million of them, Kojak, Beretta, and Barnaby Jones. And that's it's funny, too, because when they did that 1981 Beverly Hillbillies no, they did the movie with Diedrich Bader and Cloris Leachman and Lily Tomlin played Jane Hathaway, which was genius. Buddy Ebsen made a cameo as Barnaby Jones, which is kind of funny. So he didn't want to be Jed Clampett because he couldn't be because there was a Jim Varney, I think, played him. But he did Barnaby Jones, which is kind of funny.
And I think he was an author. He wrote several books. And I think at least one of the books was a mystery based on his Barnaby Jones character.
Oh, really?
It was like a Barnaby Jones mystery book. Yeah.
It was a comfort show. It was a fun. It's one of those cool shows you can tune into and it ends, you know, at the end of it. You know,
right.
And you don't feel like shit after watching it.
The next person to pass away was the show creator, Paul Hennig, who passed away on March 25th, 2005. He was 93. I don't have a cause of death. Cause of death was 93.
Yeah, he was a genius. And he wrote the theme song and the lyrics, too, that were performed by...
He was like
a
Sherwood Schwartz.
Yeah.
You know?
Flat and Scruggs were the performers. That was cool because they would have, like, real country performers on it. I remember Roy Clark played Cousin Roy and that was pretty cool to expose America. I'd never heard bluegrass before, and I loved it. And they used to do those dance. I forgot there was a word that they used and they would do these dancing things.
The hoedown.
Yeah, yeah, in the big entryway because it was the biggest set they had. but and his daughter was Linda Kay Hennig, who played Betty Jo. He wrote for Fibber McGee and Molly in the Bob Cummings Show, and. You know, it's funny. You know, with the Hollywood Walk of Fame, now the stars are $50,000.
Yeah, I was just hearing that. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, but they refused Paul Hennig. They rejected an application to give Paul Hennig a star on the walk. Now, Tinkerbell has one.
That's crazy.
Godzilla has one.
The Dodgers have one.
Yeah,
Smirnoff Vodka or whatever it is has one. Right?
Max Factor. I mean, they all have, but they said no to Paul Henning's application.
I took a picture of Felicity Huffman's star earlier this week, and I posted it. I posted and I said, yeah, ironically, you have to pay to get on the Walk of Fame, too.
Ooh.
Burn!
I'm so sad about her. I like her so much. Well, what's a big deal? Well, anyway, I shouldn't say that. But I mean,
Scott wades into the controversy.
No, but there are crimes. You know, clearly white collar crime. It's like in the broad scheme of things, I don't care who gets into Harvard. You know,
right?
I care about what's going on in my life. I just I like her. That's why I was disappointed to hear that she was involved in something like that. But that other one is that you know, pay her to post
Lori Loughlin.
Was that her name?
Yeah.
Her. But she is one to watch because I'm very curious how her thing plays out. Felicity Huffman, she just, you know, she went, yeah, I did it, and I'm not going to deny it. And she issued apologies right away. But the other one is, yeah. How do we get started on that? Oh, the Walk of Fame, Paul Hennig, yeah.
Yeah.
Poor Paul Hennig. And what a great guy. I mean, Steve, my friend Steve was really good friends with the Hennigs. And I just hear such nice things about them.
Next on the list, Donna Douglas, who was Ellie Mae Clampett, passed away just a few years ago on January 1st, New Year's Day, 2015, 82 years old, pancreatic cancer. And she was the daughter.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and beautiful. She said that she was paid $500 a week for the show. And by the time the ninth season rolled around, they got $3,000.
That's
$3,000 in 1972, or was it 71?
71.
So I don't know what that turns out to be, but it's still nothing, and I bet they got no residuals.
Right.
And I always wonder why creators aren't generous with their own. You know, like Sherwood Schwartz could have been. And, you know, you hear nice things about Sherwood and Paul Hennig, but why couldn't, maybe they did. Maybe he did. Because you don't hear the hillbillies bitching about not having any money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're all dead now, but
right.
You never heard that. Max never complained about it.
So $3,000 would be about 19 grand today.
That's nice.
So I mean, grand a week
to
be on a hit show, I guess.
And they didn't have the expenses that we have nowadays, so good for them.
They didn't have cell phone bills.
Right. she was something, though. She was a piece of work. She
and you could buy a house for $19,000 back then.
Like, oh, my God. In California.
Right.
And it was probably before property taxes became a thing, too. No, she was really nice. Now, she was at the Jerry Springer thing, and I got to talk to her for a little while, and she's clearly, like, a little loopy. And I remember getting a picture taken with her, and I asked if I could put my arm around her, and she's like, not my waist. And I was like, okay, that's personal space. I respect that, you know. She was very nice to me. But she did a movie with Elvis, Frankie and Johnny.
Right.
And as I understand it, she had a thing with Elvis. And Elvis dumped her, and she lost her mind, literally. They found her walking around the valley, like babbling incoherently. And the police picked her up. And the only... it's terrible. I shouldn't be laughing. But she had a breakdown.
Right.
And the police picked her up. And the only thing they could get out of her mouth was Paul Henning and his phone number. They called Paul Henning. The police called Paul Henning, and they came, and she stayed with them.
Wow.
But after that, Steve Cox told me the story, and he told me it was okay to repeat the story, too, that you know, everyone, whenever he interviewed anyone for the book, is, did you ask Donna about Elvis? You know, because she is one thing that she just could not talk about. And I guess she was doing an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies, because it was during, like, the third or fourth season that she did this movie, that she couldn't, like, they gave, I guess in the movie she shoots Elvis or something like that, and they gave her a shotgun, and she just started breaking down crying, and she couldn't touch the gun in on the set of the Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh.
So she kind of lost it.
Huh.
And she actually sued Disney for $200 million for stealing Sister Act from her.
That's right, because she had a pitch about nuns or something
like
that.
Yeah, Nun on the Run or Nun on the Clock.
She lost it.
Yeah, yeah.
And she basically said afterwards that, you know, they would have to have copied us word for word for us to have won our lawsuit, was kind of her argument at the end.
Interesting.
She lost, yeah.
I saw her at a couple of those autograph shows towards the end, and she still wore the rope belt. You know, she was like 75. I mean, she was really nice. She was really
nice.
But she still
see,
wore
you know?
The hair, mm-hmm. and it was very Baby Jane. Very
right.
Baby Jane. And but very kind, you know, but just... Clearly, she cut some gospel records too.
Right,
and
right.
There's some, remember the Linda McCartney isolated vocals?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what it's like. It's
up there with I'm Just a Fan or whatever.
Oh my God, Bonnie, yes. Not quite that bad, but along that line. There's one she did called He's Still Working on Me. It's got to be on YouTube, and you got to listen to that. It's so out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's but she talked, she's trying to sound like a little baby girl when she sings. It's just, oh, it's creepy. But
wow.
you gotta find, it's good. It's good. For all the wrong reasons.
Are those all your Donna stories?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. Yeah.
The last someone who is still alive is Max Baer Jr., who was Jethro. He is 81 years old, still out there kicking. Interestingly, he...
81?
He's now 81.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So he was quite a bit younger, a few years younger than Donna Douglas was. Kind of like Tina Louise on the Gilligan's Island, he was kind of bitter for a few decades after the show, because he got typecasted as Jethro, you know, the dumb hillbilly, right?
Yeah.
And so everything he was getting offered was that kind of stuff, and he was kind of tired of it. And then I think later in life, kind of maybe as he got to the retirement age, he came back around and
he did the Springer thing, and I think that was the first thing that he did.
And he did not do the reunion that was done a couple in 73.
Good for him, really. That was awful.
But all the other main cast members that were still alive at that point did it, and he didn't.
There were only two, weren't there? I mean, it was
three, I think. Yeah,
Donna, Buddy, and Culp, Nancy Culp. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But that was awful. Imogen Coca played Grant. Oh, so bad.
And it was like one of the Gilligan's Island ones we talked about, where it was meant to possibly be a pilot. For a reboot of the series, and then
never going to happen.
It didn't happen.
That is almost physically painful.
The plot sounded horrible.
I don't even remember. I will watch every reunion show, even if I know it's going to be bad.
It sounded really bad. Yeah.
I don't doubt it. But Max was, you know, father. His father was Max Baer Sr., the boxer who died in the Roosevelt Hotel. And he said that Beverly Hillbillies sort of started right after that, after his dad died. So Buddy was sort of his surrogate father. And they were really close. They were close until the end.
Yeah.
And it was when we went to that We went to that Jerry Springer thing. I had dinner with Max the night before they were taping. Myself, Steve Cox, and Max at dinner. And I just remember I left the table and I was making phone calls. You're never going to guess what I'm doing right now. Having dinner with Jethro. But no, he was really nice. But he was being kind of dicky about it because I think he'd been drinking. Uh-huh. And he was saying, man, I don't think I'm going to do the show tomorrow. You know, and they flew him there from wherever he lives. He was a nice guy. They were all nice people.
Yeah.
But he was just being a bit dicky because it was the first time the three of them were going to be together, you know, in many, many years, at least on screen.
Sure.
And it was a really special time. It was pretty cool. And, you know, he dated Sharon Tate.
So I was going to get to that.
Of course we were going to get to that.
So, of course, we can't do this and not talk about Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
So Sharon Tate was in 15 episodes, I believe, of the show with a span of one or two seasons.
She was a character in one season. Mm-hmm. She played a secretary.
She played
at the
bank. Three different people, but there was a main character.
Yeah. Janet Trigo.
Yeah, so she played Trigo, who was like the secretary at the bank.
Yeah, and she was an extra, featured extra, mm-hmm. in an episode where Ellie went to a finishing school.
Right.
And there was another one. There's a great picture of her and Max like laughing on the set of the cement pond. That's on
the cement pond with the stone lady pouring water into.
I love that. Oh my god! I always wanted a house like that after that.
they had her in a black wig. So she was almost unrecognizable.
I think that was the point.
One of the, I read this on your page or on your website.
Oh no, what did I write?
One of the directors wrote of her, when we first got her, she couldn't even walk through the door convincingly.
You know what?
And then she got acting lessons and, you know, she got better.
It's true. There is an episode where she literally walks through the door and she's adjusting her costume as she's walking in the door.
it's like, you're on camera.
Yeah, yeah. No, she wasn't. I think they insisted that she wear the wig because they knew that Filmways was putting her in garbage shows mm-hmm. and movies, and they wanted to get her out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually she did, but she was under contract with Filmways, and it's where they did Don't Make Waves, et cetera. But, mm-hmm. but yeah, she and Max dated for a while. And, of course, the throwaway, she's beautiful on the inside and out. Right. Well, Max wouldn't know, really, but I mean, it's one of those throwaway when somebody dies, you know, of course, Sharon Tate, rest in peace.
Well, on that talk show, he said they went out a couple of times. So I don't know how deep the relationship is.
They certainly worked together a lot.
Yeah.
Well, is the Springer show on air? Is it online?
Yeah, it was Springer or Povich? Springer?
Springer.
Povich, yeah, okay, Springer. Yeah, I did see one. I think it was Springer.
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it's
maybe
on there.
You can
see
it.
The whole thing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's poor quality
of
the recording of it, but yeah, it's all there. And they you know, one of the, it was a someone in the audience that asked the question about, did anybody date? Because they were referencing the Brady Bunch.
You know why?
Brady Bunch had dated, and someone in the audience asks, did any of you date? And that's where that came out.
I can take credit for that. Mm. That was Steve that asked that, and I told him to ask him that. So I will take credit for that. He did, because Steve said, yeah, you dated Sharon Tate for a while, didn't you? Yeah. So, but yeah, that's, I was sticking it out there 25, 30 years ago.
You're OG.
But, you know, Max is another one that, he produced Ode to Billy Joe. He bought the rights to Ode to Billy Joe, the Bobby Gentry song, and made the Robbie Benson movie.
Yeah, he was a pioneer in that idea of taking a song and making a movie out of the song title, basically, which became a thing.
And he owned the rights to Like a Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
He bought the rights and sued and won $2 million.
Madonna, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know what he was ever going to do with them, but I mean, I don't know what was done with them that made him sue, but he did sue and he did win.
I believe the studio didn't want him to make the Like a Virgin movie or did something to prevent him from making it or something, and he sued them and he got $2 million out of the deal. So I don't know the specifics
of it. It's so wild to buy rights to songs like that. You know, what are you going to do with that?
Right.
Fascinating.
But you know, we said that when Disney said they were going to start making movies out of their rides, and then
that's
Pirates of the Caribbean franchise,
Haunted Mansion movie with Eddie Murphy, they screwed that up big time. That could have been wonderful, and that was really too bad.
That was my favorite ride as a kid.
Yeah, still is
Haunted Mansion,
which opened on the day of the Tate murders.
Whoa.
It really did. August 9th, 1969, or August 8th, is when the Haunted Mansion opened.
Holy cow.
The day of the murders.
Wow.
Here we go again. But Max, I know for a while, remember he was trying to open Jethro's casino. He was trying to get a casino off the ground, and he was going to have Granny's Shotgun Wedding Chapel and Ellie Mae's Critter Shop or whatever. and all you can eat, all you can eat buffet.
How would he get the rights to do that? I have to wonder.
He probably bought the rights.
Huh, right.
You know, Buddy was on board too, but it just never happened. I think the only thing that ever happened were slot machines. There are Beverly Hills, there's slot machines for everything
of
out
course.
There, but
right.
but the ones I wrote down. Porn star Christy Canyon sold a story that he was too kinky. He was into big boobs, strippers, and porn stars. So, all right. That's not, okay.
Well, that makes him very unusual, yes.
She said he wanted to watch her have sex with two Chippendale dancers. And he said that she was lying. He said, if I wanted to watch her have sex with two guys, I'd rent one of her movies.
Ouch.
But, you know, the Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction and Green Acres, it was so cool because they called it cross pollination, where these people would pop in to the other shows,
right?
And
yes.
There was that one Thanksgiving episode where they
crossover episodes, yeah,
and they all got together at the Shady Rest. All three casts of all three shows got together for one Thanksgiving episode. I loved that when they reference each other, and you know, it was cool. It did continuity.
It's like when Batman would show up on Scooby Doo, man, you knew that was going to be a special morning,
you know?
Yeah,
Cass Elliot with the donut shop. Yeah, that was cool. And there's also an album that they cut. They did cut an album, a Beverly Hillbillies record.
Oh.
And Jed had a song, Buddy Ebsen sang it. You know, one of these days, like, I'm going to have a long talk with that boy was one of his songs. And
right.
Granny sang a song called Vittles. You know, what you cooking for Vittles, Granny? And she goes, let me take a peek in my pot. it's fun. It's a really fun album.
Uh-huh.
But back when they did cool stuff back then. You know, nobody even cares. Like, there's no shows that give you that feeling anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no casts that are even really that memorable.
Right.
I don't know. It was a good time. It was a good time for TV back then.
Oh, and back then, like you said, 60 million people would watch. Like, there's such a flood of channels and shows now that no show is ever going to come anywhere near touching that.
I mean, what's the population of Los Angeles, you know?
Right.
Or even the country. You know, what is the population
of
the country?
I mean, at the time, that was probably like a third of the country, half the country.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that range, yeah.
That's
tuned in to watch
astronomical.
To watch a sitcom.
Yeah. You know, and it was so funny, too, the way they were. I remember they got, for Christmas, they got a boat. The Drysdales bought them a boat. And they're going to go to take it on the L.A. River. And I remember this in like North Hollywood, and they're looking down in the L.A. River. You know, it's all concrete, and there's like a five-foot patch of. And I just remember looking down and go, pitiful, pitiful. There were some funny bits in that. I remember when they went to England, and they had a butler named Faversham, and they thought that was the way you greeted people. So every time they saw somebody, they go, Faversham.
How did they make a 9-season, 270-some episode show out of basically one gimmick?
Yeah.
That's what's crazy, because it wasn't like a Gilligan's Island where it was only on for a few years, but it just left a big impact. It was on for 9 seasons. Like, how?
They had a whole city to
crazy,
work with.
Right?
They, you know, Gilligan's Island had one island, which is pretty incredible.
Right.
But they had the whole city, and they went out on location. They went to Marineland, and they went to England. But they would, they'd go out into the roads. You know that famous scene at the beginning with them driving down Beverly Hills? That's Beverly Drive between Santa Monica heading north to Sunset.
So they were going north. Okay.
Yeah.
I was trying to
place it. They were coming
south.
I don't even know.
They were probably coming.
It's a curved street. So they were coming from the Beverly Hills Hotel towards Santa Monica.
So coming
Boulevard.
South down.
Yeah. Okay.
With the palm trees, the famous palm tree line.
You can match
streets.
Them up, too. You can.
Because I'm sure a lot of the houses are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool. That was a good time. And the Commerce Bank still exists on Wilshire Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
The Drysdale House is gone now, I think. But yeah, look at that. Max is the only one that's left. And there you are. That's it. But Nancy, one of our listeners, Nancy, is the one who suggested this. So thanks, Nancy, for the suggestion.
Thank you, Nancy. And we also got a suggestion that we do an OJ episode.
Okay.
Which I can't argue against.
Okay.
I see no reason not to do
absolutely
that.
Absolutely, 100%.
We're doing an OJ episode, yes.
Yeah, for sure. That'd
we'll
be interesting.
We'll take a stab at it.
Oh my God, stop. We just have to follow OJ's Twitter now, and there's probably going to be some good fodder for
and
conversation.
You know, he hasn't been verified yet, but both tweets I've seen have been videos of him talking to fans. So, I mean, it's almost definitely legitimate. I don't know how else you would get that footage.
No,
doing
I think
that,
it's
so.
I think it's legit.
It's him, It's crazy.
Those poor kids.
The
oh
juice
my God.
Is loose on Twitter.
Juice.
Well, is that it?
I think it's it.
All right, y'all come back now.
You hear? This has been a Film Waste presentation.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.